From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Noah Adams.
I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up, cities and states continue to feel the pain of the economic downturn. We'll have the latest unemployment numbers from the nation's metropolitan areas. They're out today. They don't look good.
But first, for the second day in a row, President-elect Barack Obama huddles with his economic advisors. They're talking about ways to rein in government spending, but only after the immediate economic crisis is passed. In the short term, Mr. Obama is urging Congress to quickly approve hundreds of billions of dollars in new government spending and tax cuts to keep the economy from getting worse. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Scott, is this sort of a mixed blessing coming from the Obama transition camp, do you think? How do they feel about it?
Well, the Obama camp is trying to send really two messages here, one for the short term and one for the long term. In the short term, Mr. Obama says, the top priority is to stop the bleeding. He has warned that there have been, of course, terrible job losses over the last year, and he's expecting another dire jobs report at the end of this week. He said yesterday that the federal government has to act to arrest the downward momentum in the economy, or else the next few years will be even worse. So the government is hoping to do that by, on the one hand, spending hundreds of billions of dollars itself, and by providing hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts to encourage working people and businesses to spend. Now, over the longer term, once the patient is out of intensive care, the Obama team wants to put the federal government on a diet and get it to shape up.
Well, when you look at that longer term, now what's the plan for that? What do they intend to do?
Well, that's what the president-elect and his economic advisors are talking about today. And some of the things they're talking about are the things we hear every 4 years from every politician, eliminating waste, streamlining the government, making it more efficient, reviewing the budget page by page, line by line, and that sort of thing. But they're also talking about trying to get a hold of some of the really big ticket items, including health care, which otherwise will consume a bigger and bigger share of the federal budget. Peter Orszag, Mr. Obama's pick to head the White House Budget Office, made a specialty of studying health care costs when he was working at the Congressional Budget Office. And so that's one of the big things they'll be looking to try to do, to gain control of rising health care bills, which are affecting the government's budget in the same way they're affecting so many family and business budgets.
Anyway, this week, which is the big first week of work on Capitol Hill, Barack Obama appears to be the president. He seems to be running things. Tell us what he's doing for the economic stimulus in the meantime.
That's right. He's made a personal lobbying trip to Capitol Hill yesterday. He met with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, with Senator Harry Reid. He also met with some of the leading Republicans from the House and Senate. He is really trying to build bipartisan support for this huge economic stimulus package. And one way he's doing that is by framing some of the stimulus, a significant chunk of the stimulus, in the shape of tax cuts, which warms the hearts of some of the Republicans. And even though some Republicans and even some Democrats are skeptical about the overall size of the stimulus package, both sides say they are encouraged by the sort of spirit of bipartisanship and the willingness to listen that the incoming administration is showing.
What is the timing? When do they expect to have a bill back to President Obama's desk?
Well, initially, of course, they had hoped to have a stimulus measure awaiting the new president's signature pretty much as soon as he took office. They're now saying that's unlikely. But Mr. Obama said yesterday he still hopes to work quickly on this and to have a stimulus measure in the next 6 weeks or so.
And the more immediate news today, Roland Burris, who considers himself to be the junior senator from Illinois, came to work and was turned away. That was quite a show. What's going to be the reaction with the Obama people about that?
Well, the Obama camp has deliberately steered clear of the Capitol today and that spectacle. But Mr. Obama has said previously that while he respects Mr. Burris, anyone appointed by Governor Blagojevich would be tainted.
NPR Scott Horsley talking with us from Washington. Thank you, Scott.
Good to be with you, Noah.
One of the folks who has been advising the president-elect and other Democratic leaders in Congress is Mark Zandi. He's the chief economist for Moody's Economy.com, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program, Mr. Zandi.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Zandi, you served as an advisor for Senator John McCain's presidential campaign, and now you've been working with the Democrats in leadership. I'm wondering, what sort of advice are you giving them for how to get out of the situation?
Well, I think the most important thing is that government policy needs to be very aggressive. We need a concerted, comprehensive, and consistent response to our economic problems. The crisis is very severe and significant, and without such a response, we're going to be in the economic soup, so to speak, for a long time to come.
And specifically, I'm sure there's many things you've suggested. Could you give us a couple of highlights of concrete plans?
Well, the thing that's on the drawing board right now is the economic stimulus plan, and I think we do need a very large plan that would include increases in government spending and tax cuts.
To add to this troubled economy, we now have the latest unemployment figures out this morning for major metropolitan areas. Here's how they look. In November 2007, 18 areas reported jobless rates of at least 7%. In November 2008, that number jumped to 121. Which areas have seen the highest unemployment rate?
Well, the most significant problems are in the industrial Midwest. As we all know, the auto industry is having a great deal of difficulty, and layoffs have been very severe. Also in parts of the country where the housing market has been hit hard, California, Florida, Arizona, Nevada, there too employment has fallen and unemployment has risen.
And which areas are seeing the lowest unemployment numbers?
They're generally in the interior parts of the country, the Farm Belt. But one of the hallmarks of the current downturn is that the problems, the economic problems, are broad-based across the country. In most recessions that we've experienced, the problems are very regionally concentrated, and that's not the case in this downturn. It is coast to coast.
National and state unemployment numbers will be out at the end of this week. What should we expect looking at a total loss for 2008?
Well, I think we'll see total job losses for the year of about 2.4 million people. Another 500,000 jobs will be lost in December, so that will bring the total to 2.4 million. The unemployment rate will probably end the year at 7%. The low was 4.4% back in March of 2007, so it gives you a real sense of how severe the economic problems are and why we need a big government response, particularly a big economic stimulus package.
President-elect Barack Obama has talked about creating 3 million jobs when he takes office. Will that solve the problem? Can you automatically translate the 2.5 million or so people without jobs into these new jobs he hopes to create?
Well, it won't solve the problem, but it'll certainly help. And I think we just have to think about what the world would look like if we don't do something like this economic stimulus plan that's being discussed and debated. You know, I think we would see unemployment well into the double digits. We'd lose 7.5-8 million jobs. Numbers that are very hard to get your mind around. So I think he's not going to be able to get the economy back up and running quickly. But if we don't do something like this, the economy will be struggling for many, many years to come.
Mark Zandi is chief economist for MoodysEconomy.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
A county in northwestern Ohio has nearly 11% unemployment. That's the highest in the state. NPR's Celeste Headley talked with people there about the months to come.
The wind is blowing hard outside this shopping center in Van Wert. Customers like Jadine Vance are rushing to get into the warmth of Walmart as quickly as they can. Vance says the winter cold is an added hardship for the people here.
In wintertime and stuff, people can't afford to heat their houses. And stuff like that, you know, it's pretty bad when they got to choose between heat and food.
Vance says she's seen businesses closing all over town and foreclosure signs on nearly every street.
I think if something doesn't happen, you know, there's going to be a lot more places go out of business and people lose their houses.
This is a common theme among people in Van Wert. The working class town has about 10,000 people, and the home ownership rate in 2000 was over 80%. It's much lower now. Everyone here seems to know people who've lost their jobs or their homes this year.
Some of my neighbors that have lost their jobs are now out looking and trying to find a job.
One of the girls that I work with lost her job. They had to move out of their apartment and move in with her husband's parents.
Well, a lot of foreclosures. It's happening everywhere, but it's happening to us too.
And I've been here all my life, and this place has always been good. Not no more.
That's Dan Custis, Stephanie Littman, Nancy Konopke, and Todd Hart. Hart says a lot of his friends have already moved on.
Everybody's wanting to leave. All the businesses are going out of business. You can't afford to do anything, so everybody's losing their houses, losing their cars.
Hart works for Superior Auto Sales. He says his job is secure, for now.
I'm figuring it's going to trickle down to us about another year.
then what happens then?
Move to another town.
Thousands of people in Van Wert County worked for companies that supply parts to the big three, like Kongsberg. That company shut down its Ohio plant and outsourced the work to Mexico.
We're actually in the lap of two of the hardest hit industries in the country, the RV industry and the automotive industry.
Nancy Bowen is the economic development director for the city of Van Wert. She says the tough times are bringing out the best in people.
What we have seen is a community that's responding.
Bowen says the Salvation Army, local churches, and other service organizations have been working hard to make sure that everyone in Van Wert gets the help they need.
We went through a tornado in 2002, and we saw the community really solidify and come together, and that's what I'm seeing right now.
Bowen says there's no denying that it's a tough time. Drive down the street from City Hall, and you'll see a dozen closed businesses before you go a mile. For sale signs in front of homes say, owner will help you finance. But Van Wert Mayor Louis Emer says people here are prepared to weather the storm.
I'm from Detroit. I was with Chrysler's in the 70s when we went through the thing with Iacocca. And it was doom and gloom for a while, but people just dig in and we pick ourselves up.
Even though I visited on a weekend, I had to drive for miles before I found a shopping center with more than a handful of cars in the parking lot. But people outside this little mall agree with the mayor. Van Wert will survive.
You have to understand, the people here in Van Wert are very resilient. We don't give up.
I mean, they're very faithful to Van Wert. If you grew up here, you're going to do what you can to stay.
Dan Custis and Stephanie Littman. Joblessness here is sure to get worse before it gets better, though. Many people are about to see their unemployment expire, and the state unemployment fund is almost out of money. Ohio's governor estimates the fund will need $500 million from the government this month in order to stay in the black. Celeste Headlee, NPR News.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
And I'm Noah Adams. The U.S. government recently approved a $400 million aid package to Mexico to fight drug trafficking.
Some of that money will go to the Mexican army to help police fight the drug trade. The public, though, is suspicious of the military's participation in the drug war.
Independent producer Scott Carrier has the second part of a three-part series on Juarez, Mexico. A word to parents, the piece does contain some disturbing descriptions.
Last March, President Felipe Calderon sent 3,000 soldiers to Chihuahua, most of them to Juarez, one of the biggest battlefields in the drug war. The decision was widely supported by the Mexican people, who were tired of corrupt police, corrupt judges, corrupt everything, and the bad guys always getting away. The troops arrived, but still, things got worse, much worse. Bodies started showing up in public places with lists of names of others who would be killed, including high-ranking police officers. The police became afraid to go to work. Kidnappings, carjackings, extortions all increased to record levels. The troops patrolled the streets in armored vehicles mounted with machine guns, dressed in full battle gear, helmets, flak jackets, knee pads. They could have driven their armored vehicles to the drug lords' houses. It's no secret where they live. And yet, no drug lords have been arrested in Juarez. Instead, the Army, together with federal, state, and municipal police, have focused on poor neighborhoods. Josefina Reyes Salazar lives in Guadalupe, a village just outside Juarez.
It was 4:30 in the morning, Sunday, the 9th of June. The Army broke into my house, breaking down doors, breaking things, turning over mattresses, the cabinets, everything, and even stealing things. They had on blue clothes. They wore round helmets and blue or black clothes with masks. They had no search warrant or arrest warrant. They arrived, beat up the family, beat the men, and they took one member of the family away. I want to tell you that it wasn't just at my house. There were around 30 houses where these kind of events happened.
From March to mid-June of 2008, the Attorney General's office in Juarez received 50 complaints against the Army, complaints accusing the military of such things as forcibly disappearing citizens and torture by electric shocks and simulated suffocations with plastic bags. Many people we spoke with in Juarez believe the Mexican military was directly involved in some of the executions that had taken place in their city because of the way they happened. The assassins, they say, arrive in SUVs with shaded windows and no license plates. They wear black clothes and black ski masks and carry automatic rifles and pistols. People say they position themselves around their target in disciplined and practiced maneuvers. These armed commandos are said to travel the city at night when the streets are empty without being pursued by the military. So, the reasoning goes, they must be from the military. On August 13th, at a drug rehab center in a poor part of the city, 30 recovering drug addicts were attending a prayer meeting led by Socorro Garcia, an evangelical preacher. She was there, and she survived to tell the story.
Fue un día normal.
It was a normal day, a Wednesday like any other. And every Wednesday we went to this center, and we would sing and preach. There were young people, sometimes 13 or 14 years old, and there were also very old people, 60, 62 years old. I told them, muchachos, you need to turn to God. Is there someone brave enough to accept Christ into your heart? Is there any one of you here who was a Christian in the past but who fell away into drugs and who would like to reconcile with God? All of a sudden, you could hear a whole lot of gunshots. Four armed men entered the room, shooting and shooting. They were dressed like soldiers, like military men, and they wore bulletproof vests and their black ski masks, their shoes, all of it like military gear. And one of them kept looking at me. I looked into his eyes, and he didn't shoot anymore. I don't know why he stopped shooting, because I was right there in front of him, and one more life would have meant nothing to him. But he didn't shoot. Then, when everything was over, when the men went away, I grabbed my purse, and it was full of blood, all the blood that had come from the dead kids.
The coroner's report said 8 were killed and 5 were wounded at the rehab center that day. Two Juarez papers the next morning reported eyewitness testimony that a group of 7 or 8 men wearing the uniforms of a special Mexican army unit, the Red Berets, had parked about 50 yards away from the massacre site but did not come to the aid of those being attacked. The Mexican army officially denied any involvement in the crime. There are many questions. Were the assassins perhaps hitmen wearing army uniforms? After all, why would the military stand by while armed commandos kill a bunch of poor, recovering drug addicts? Charles Bowden, author of Down by the River, has covered the drug trade along the border extensively. He says in Juarez, you don't get answers to these kinds of questions.
It is possible that the people that killed the people in the drug rehab center were impersonating the military, but there's no reason for them to do it. You don't have to have a costume to kill people. You can speculate why you would slaughter people in a rehab center, but you drift into fantasy land. You say, oh, maybe they were selling drugs. You say, oh, maybe they were hiding gang members. You say they must be dirty or they wouldn't be dead. But in fact, you don't know anything. The only thing you ever get to know in Juarez, if you're lucky, are the names of the dead. You don't get to know who killed them. You don't get to know why they were killed.
Bowden says people in Juarez have come to accept violence in their city like they accept the dust that fills the air whenever the wind blows. They breathe it in and move through it, because what other choice do they have?
Juarez is, like Mexico, is a series of gangs. There's a city police gang. There's a state police gang. There's a federal police gang. There's the army, a separate gang. And then there's 500 independent gangs. And then there's the cartels. And so what you get is a society that's disintegrating, fighting for a piece of the pie. And in the crossfire, the Mexican people get slaughtered. That's the situation in Juarez today and in much of Mexico.
As I sit at my computer 1,000 miles north of the border, I read the latest news from Juarez. One night, in the space of a half hour, armed commandos launch 4 attacks on police in different parts of the city. 4 bodies are found at a dog racing track. One of the bodies is decapitated, the head placed between the legs, wearing a Santa Claus hat. Next to the body is a list of police officers who will be killed in the near future. The amazing thing is tomorrow morning people in Juarez will get up and go to work, and life will continue. For NPR News, I'm Scott Carrier.
Our Juarez series is a production of HearingVoices.com.
Tomorrow, the final report on how some fear that organized crime fueled by the drug trade is now more powerful than the country's government.
The violence continues in the Gaza Strip. Earlier today, Israeli tank shells killed more than 34 Palestinians who sought refuge at a United Nations school in northern Gaza. Health officials say at least 58 Palestinians were killed in fighting today, just two of them confirmed as militants. And one of the two dozen rockets fired from Gaza wounded an Israeli infant.
According to the latest UN numbers, nearly 600 Palestinians have been killed. 10 Israelis have died since the operation began on December 27th, including a soldier who was shot today. As the civilian death toll rises, the international community's calls for a ceasefire are increasing, too. State Department spokesman Sean McCormick says the U.S. supports that idea.
We would like an immediate ceasefire, absolutely. An immediate ceasefire that is durable, sustainable, and not time-limited.
Many of the 1.5 million people in the Gaza Strip lack food, water, or power. The International Red Cross is calling the situation a full-blown humanitarian crisis, and Israel still isn't allowing foreign journalists into Gaza to report directly on the situation. NPR's Peter Kenyon spoke with a few of the people waiting on the Egyptian side of the border and sent us this report.
The border area is full of surprises, even moments of comedy. In the rush to transfer medical supplies from an Egyptian 18-wheeler to a Palestinian truck before the border closes again, accidents can happen. Volunteers scramble for cover as a tall stack of boxes tips, teeters, and then crashes to the pavement. There are some worried looks, but according to the labels, the cases are filled with bandages from Germany. No harm done. Immediately, several people begin giving very loud and contradictory instructions to the truck drivers. Come on, pull up closer. No, stop. Lending a Keystone Cops flavor to the scene until you remember why they're here. People who have been here for several days say these explosions are closer and louder than any they've heard so far. With the Israeli army moving into parts of the southern Gaza Strip, it's hard to see how these several tons of medical supplies will get all the way to the main Shifa hospital in the northern part of the strip, because the main roads inside Gaza have been cut. Still, a few ambulances are getting out. At the count of 1, 2, 3, medical crews lift a wounded Palestinian man from one stretcher to another and shift him into an Egyptian ambulance for transport to a nearby hospital. Standing perhaps 100 yards away is Mohammed Khawaldi, a Jordanian neurosurgeon in a rumpled brown suit. He's one of a number of doctors who are camping out at the border crossing, waiting for permission to enter Gaza and work alongside their exhausted Palestinian colleagues.
I'm here to help the people of Gaza, and we're not here to take up arms. We're here to heal and help the wounded. Especially as a neurosurgeon, there are a lot of cases that have to be treated immediately.
Dr. Khawaldi says while he waits for permission to enter, he's offering to ride along in an ambulance if there's a head or spinal cord injury to provide whatever care he can.
I'm here until the war stops or until we get in. But as long as there are injuries coming out, I'm not leaving.
In another corner of the crossing area, a perfectly normal sight that now seems anything but normal. A Palestinian woman is waiting in front of a bus to go back into southern Gaza. Her name is Ragda Salha, and she spent the last 2 months in Egypt getting medical treatment. She seems nervous, but she says she has no hesitation about going back now.
I have a daughter. She's 12. She's okay, but of course she's scared because she's a child. There were attacks at her school. She has friends who have been killed, so it's natural she's scared when something like this happens. I'm scared for her, of course. God only knows what the situation is like in Gaza now. Where is all this going?
Ragda's home is in Deir al-Bala in central Gaza, where some of the latest reports of heavy fighting are coming from. But her fear for her family outweighs her fear of the coming journey. Not far away, an Egyptian pharmacist smiles wearily and rubs his eyes. He's just brought an aid convoy on a 12-hour checkpoint-filled journey from Alexandria. Yes, he agrees. It shouldn't be this hard to help people. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, at the Egypt-Gaza border.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. Everyone is hoping for an economic turnaround this year, and until that happens, many of us are looking for solid financial advice to keep our heads above water. Here to answer your personal finance questions is Michelle Singletary. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
So we're going to start off with a letter about a rule known as the 72T rule. It comes from Joan Fantasia. She lives here in Los Angeles. She's a retired journalist from the LA Times. She's 53 years old. And she asks, can you explain the 72T? There is no way I can hold out until age 59 and a half to get my 401k money. What's going on here, Michelle?
Well, the 72T rule is a rule from the IRS that states that if you have an IRA, individual retirement account, you can withdraw a fixed amount of money for a minimum of 5 years or until you're 59 and a half, whichever comes last. That's an important point. So let's say you're just a year into this and you turn 59 and a half. You still have to play out that five-year rule. So it's whichever comes last. And basically, owners have to still pay ordinary income on the distribution, but you don't have to pay that 10% penalty. So since she's so close, she could utilize this, but you have to be very, very careful about that, because if you miscalculate and you don't take enough or you take too much, you're going to be hit with that 10% penalty.
Here's a more general question. This comes from Laureen Lynn, and she says, I am a fool with money. Is there a general book or books that cover the basics of finance? What do you recommend, Michelle?
You know, there are a couple books that I really love. Let's start with College Savings, How to Go to College Almost for Free by Ben Kaplan. This is a young man who went to, I think it was Harvard, and raised like $90,000 in scholarship money. It's a great book, kind of leads you on how to apply for various scholarships. And these aren't just scholarships for like the brilliant and the genius. He just walks you through how to get as most money as you can for college. The other book is The Best Way to Save for College, A Complete Guide to 529 Plans by Joseph Hurley. For retirement, check out How to Retire Happy, the 12 Most Important Decisions You Must Make Before You Retire. It's by one of my former colleagues at the Washington Post, Stan Hendon. And the good thing about this book is he's addressing the issues that a lot of people sort of forget about or don't think about, even some of the mistakes that he and his wife made. So it's really a very honest look at the things that you need to consider when you retire, How to Retire Happy. Now, for a general basic financial book, get Smart and Simple Financial Strategies for Busy People by Jane Bryant Quinn. I love Jane's work. It's a really easy book to read. You don't even have to read it from beginning to end. You can skip chapters as it applies to you.
Okay, last question, Michelle. This comes from Jennifer Millsap from Molino, Oregon. She's married to a construction superintendent who recently was laid off. They're worried about their mortgage. The payments are about $650 a month. Jennifer has already turned a 30-year mortgage into a 12-year mortgage, which means she doubled each of her monthly payments. She asked if she should pay off the mortgage quickly, making higher payments now, or should she put the money into savings and stick to the low $650 payment?
Because her husband has lost her job, I would stop making the extra mortgage payments. They need to preserve cash until he gets another job. So if it takes longer for her husband to get a job, they have the money to pay for the everyday expenses like food and utilities and such.
Michelle Singletary answering your questions. Thank you so much, Michelle.
You're welcome.
Michelle Singletary hosts a housing special on TV One. You can check your local listings for that. She is also Day to Day's personal finance contributor.
This is Day to Day. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Why should you adopt a black cat instead of an orange one? Do dogs need a pack leader or a papa? And how do you draw blood from an antelope without terrifying it? These are some of the questions author and animal advocate Temple Grandin answers in her new book, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Temple Grandin joins us now. Welcome to the program.
It's wonderful to be here.
The thesis of your book is that there are basically four core emotional systems at work in both humans and animals. Could you give us a brief overview of these four emotional systems?
Now, these were emotional systems originally identified by Jack Panskap, a neuroscientist, and they are fear, rage, panic or separation anxiety, and goal-directed seeking behavior. You know, when you look at behavior, you got to go, okay, what emotion would be driving that behavior? And I also would like to give credit to my co-author, Katherine Johnson, on coming up with the idea of linking the core emotions to a lot of abnormal behaviors, like animals maybe chewing something up, or, you know, they're really aggressive, or they're scared and they're cowering in the corner.
And so the basic philosophy that you write about, which seems to make a lot of sense, is you stimulate this seeking mode and the play mode, and you try to avoid things like rage and fear in an animal. So let's talk a little bit about some specific animals and some theories you outline. One animal you write a chapter about is cats and how to read their emotions. And you note a really interesting point. Cats don't have eyebrows. Why should that matter?
Well, they don't have the expressive faces that dogs have. I mean, dogs, you can kind of tell what they're thinking. If you want to train a cat, the best way to do it is with clicker training, using food as a motivator, where a dog will do stuff for you just because he wants to do it, just for the social reward.
I thought it was fascinating that you suggest that when you're adopting a cat, there's certain things you might want to consider, and one of those things is color. And why is it there's certain gene traits that you're looking at that supports this idea that the black cats might be more laid back? Could you explain that?
Well, it's hard to explain why that would be connected to temperament, but I found in cattle, for example, that little hair whorls that cattle and horses have on their forehead is connected to temperament. Animals that have a hair whorl that's high up on the forehead tend to startle easily, and they're more excitable. And then animals such as the red cats, the marmalade cats, very, very affectionate, but startle really easily.
I am a dog owner, so I have to confess I was particularly interested in the dog chapter. And you wrote a lot about the dog whisperer, Cesar Millan, and his theory that's become very popular is that owners need to be this kind of dominant pack leader. But you don't entirely agree with that. What were some of the findings you had there about how we should behave with our dogs?
Well, I think if you look at wolves, you know, you don't have a whole bunch of unrelated wolves living together. You know, they actually are family units. And I think in a really artificial situation that we've created for dogs, you know, some of Caesar's methods work. But when I was a child and all the dogs just ran around loose, you know, a young dog came into somebody's house. He got socialized, you know, with the other dogs. We didn't have all the dog bites. Now, the downside is a lot of dogs were killed by cars. That was the bad part. But the dogs had, in some ways, a better quality of life, because dogs need to be socialized with other dogs, not just to people. So they kind of learn the give and take of social behavior.
These emotions that you write about, there's a basic premise throughout this book that animals do have an emotion. And I think that some critics might argue that that's anthropomorphizing a bit too much. What sort of evidence can you point to that animals really do have emotions and that they're emotions similar to humans?
Well, in the subcortical brain systems that all mammals have, it's hard neuroscience. The fear circuits, for example, were traced and documented 25 years ago. You know, Prozac works on dogs. You know, if there wasn't some similarity between dog emotion and our emotion, then why would Prozac work on dogs? And you look at how the brain systems are set up, especially in the subcortical parts of the brain, the older, more primitive parts of the brain, it's set up the same way with the same neurotransmitter substances.
I'd like to ask about your chapter on zoos, and you write about a trend that zoos have been following lately to try to make enclosures that seem natural for animals in the wild. But you write that this isn't necessarily in their best interest. Why not?
Well, if you just make an enclosure that's just a bunch of concrete rocks that looks pretty, it's still just as barren as a barren cage. You've got to give the animal the things it needs. Okay, let's take an animal that a lot of people are familiar with, like the gerbil, for example. Sometimes gerbils will get into stereotypic digging. Dig, 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 dig. So someone might say, well, let's just give the gerbil, you know, more dirt to dig in. Well, he still digs and digs. But the reason why he's digging is he wants cover. This is an animal that out in the wild wants to get under things so the hawks and the predators aren't going to eat it up. What he wants is cover. And if you give him some tunnels already dug to give him cover, then he doesn't dig. Why is the polar bear pacing? What does the polar bear do out in nature? He walks tremendous big long distances seeking. So then you got to give him something to seek. It's going to be different with different animals.
There's an anecdote in this book about a zoo that was having tremendous difficulty getting antelope from the barn where they slept every night to their exhibit at the zoo, and they had to pass through this alley, and you described that there were days that they just were struck with tremendous fear. Other days they were fine, and the zoo brought you out to investigate. What did you find?
Well, there was this stupid yellow sign that said Danger Electrical Panel. And it wasn't fastened to the electrical panel. It was leaning up against the fence. And it was out in the middle of the alley, just laying upside down with the yellow back of the sign showing. And I go, they're afraid of that sign.
And no one else had noticed it but you.
No. You've got to be observant of the little things the animal tends to notice. And I said, look, either fasten that sign permanently to the fence, or I'm going to take it, throw it out in the bushes, and we're going to just get rid of it. Because I think this is what your problem is.
And it worked.
Yeah. And it worked. You've got to look for those kinds of things.
This book covers so many different animals, and not everyone can be a full-time animal researcher. But for people listening who want to take away from this just one thing that they can do at home with their animals, whatever their animal might be, what piece of advice would you give?
Well, if it's a pet animal, dogs need a lot of attention. They just don't handle being alone very well. If you do have to be away at work all day, and get somebody else to come over and, you know, take your dog out and play with them. And you know, dogs need a lot of stuff to do.
The title of this book, Animals Make Us Human, I'm wondering if you can think back to a recent experience in all the work that you do with animals where an animal made you more human.
Well, that's a hard question. Right now when you ask me that, I'm seeing Mark's little red dog right now. I'm seeing Cheryl, my assistant's border collie. She just loves to see me. Mark works for me. He does designing and drafting work for cattle ranches now. But Mark used to have a little blue heeler dog. Then whenever I went over to his house, Annie would just roll on her back, and she just wanted lots and lots and lots of petting. She really enjoyed all that petting, and I enjoyed giving her that petting. And I want to tell you, it should be stroking, not patting, but stroking. You know, a lot of animals interpret pats as hits.
And petting the dogs makes you feel more human? How?
Well, it just makes me feel good. Like, Annie really liked having me stroke her on the belly, so. And she always wanted to see me, too.
Temple Grandin is professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She's also author of the new book, Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Thank you, Temple.
Well, thank you for having me.
For more advice from Temple Grandin, check out our blog at npr.org/daydreaming. There you can read about how I tried some of her tips with my puppy Sadie. You can also share your own pet training notes. It's all at our blog, npr.org/daydreaming.
And back now with Day to Day. When the television sitcom Scrubs returns for a new season tonight, it will be on a different network, ABC.
Why the switch after 7 years on NBC? Here's critic Andrew Wallenstein with an explanation of a rare TV trend.
How exciting is it that you run this place now? I'm so proud of you. It's like a whole new day is dawned.
Do me a big favor there, Barbu. Get that prescription filled for me.
One chill pill.
It's for you. Unlimited refills.
To understand what happened to this comedy set in a hospital, let's borrow some medical terms. Think of Scrubs as a transplanted heart. It was barely beating for all those years for its donor, NBC. You might say it was deprived of the TV equivalent of oxygenated blood. Marketing. The network was so busy pumping the life out of Scrubs, shuffling it around the schedule so much that it hemorrhaged more and more viewers with each move. But even a faint pulse is enough for ABC, which has flatlined in the comedy department in recent years. So a show that once seemed on life support has been resuscitated in a new body, leaving one question. Can it survive? If TV history is any indication, maybe. Yes, strange as it might seem for a show to suddenly switch networks, it's by no means unprecedented. In fact, some of TV's most iconic shows have changed channels, but for very different reasons, with very different results. Even the Beaver was a lever. After one season on CBS in 1957, it jumped to ABC the following year. Turns out the show's main sponsor, Purina Dog Chow, offered the latter network a sweeter deal. 50 years later, money is still typically the primary factor in network swaps. Just look at the Bravo hit Project Runway, which Lifetime is trying to steal away by paying the producers more, a move that has the two companies battling it out in court. The thing about TV shows is, the longer they run, the more expensive they get to produce. That's why the WB passed on Buffy the Vampire Slayer back in 2001, when it eked out two more seasons on UPN. Same thing happened in 1965 to that sitcom classic My Three Sons. But in that case, ABC's loss was CBS's gain. The show managed to make it seven more seasons. Sometimes a change of scenery can work wonders, as NBC found out the hard way twice during the 1990s. Both Baywatch and JAG floundered for a year at the Peacock network before going on to long, successful runs elsewhere. But more often than not, these kind of swaps are futile attempts to squeeze the last ounce of juice out of an already drained fruit. Taxi, Different Strokes, and Family Matters are just a few of the shows that made for sloppy seconds. Scrubs seems like it's likely to follow in that tradition. Eight seasons is like a century, given most comedies are lucky to last eight episodes. The fact that ABC thinks it can extract value out of Scrubs' last lap speaks to the state of diminishing returns on TV today.
Andrew Wallenstein is deputy editor of The Hollywood Reporter.
The Screen Actors Guild will be voting on a possible strike in a few weeks, and that concerns Hollywood. Last year's writer's strike cost the local economy in Los Angeles hundreds of millions of dollars. And during that strike, Day-to-Day checked in a couple of times with Corey Lavelle. She's back with us on the telephone. Hi, Ms. Lavelle.
Hi, Noah.
The name of your company is?
Sandy Rose Floral. We're a floral prop house exclusively to the studio industry.
So if you are a show like, for example,
Desperate Housewives, Heroes, Days of Our Lives, we've done four Christmases, the film, Benjamin Button, and Soul Men, just to name a few.
So some days it could be a lot of flowers going out.
Some days, but not in this past year.
How has the past year been?
Well, initially with the writer's strike about a year ago at the same time, the industry almost came to a standstill. And all of us independent vendors to the studios really believed that once that strike was over, there'd be a huge surge in production. And that's never really happened. We've never really recovered completely in this past year.
I know that you had to lay people off during the previous strike. Were you able to bring them back on the job?
No, I haven't. They've taken jobs elsewhere.
They're gone. Good people, too, probably.
Very good people. People I had working for me 8 to 10 years.
Now, earlier you told us, you were talking about the way your business was running, and you said even if your doors were closed, you were at $25,000. Was it a week?
Yes.
And I assume you've had to bring that way down.
I have. I no longer drive a car. I drive a shop van. I've been driving that for a year after I turned my car in. In lots of different ways. We've cut everything we can think of to the absolute bone. And as a matter of fact, we're having a liquidation sale this weekend.
Liquidating what? What are you going to sell?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of prop houses are in the same position I am, and we are selling off assets we've acquired throughout the years that the studios use to produce their films and television shows.
What are you going to have to take that you really don't want to leave your shop?
Well, I have things, everything from candles to furniture to chandeliers, and other prop houses have things ranging from clothing to coffins.
Coffins?
Yes.
Right.
prop house coffins. I know one of the prop houses sold some Star Wars pieces. We're all in dire straits, and these are the things we've been pushed to have to do.
So if you got a production jacket from some show or movie.
Exactly. That may be there.
That's kind of sad.
It is sad.
Hey, what do you think is going to happen in 2009?
You know, I used to try to predict throughout 2008 what I thought was going to happen, but right now the way negotiations for SAG and the AMPTP are going in particular, they're at a stalemate. And until that is resolved, I can't even begin to predict what's going to happen. We need production to come back.
In the meantime, you're just going to lay low.
Meantime, I'm just going to lay low, hope for each job that comes in every week to cover my overhead, which has happened, luckily, throughout the last year. But I'm not making any profit at this point. I'm just surviving.
Corey Lavelle, she owns Sandy Rose Floral in North Hollywood. Flowers to the industry. Here in Los Angeles. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Alex Cohen.